Quer saber de que forma a ciência e tecnologia estão a alterar e melhorar ou até piorar as nossas vidas? Está no sítio certo. Hoje é um episódio especial, já que temos connosco nada mais nada menos do que a mulher mais temida por Google, Facebook e companhia, Margrethe Vestager, a vice-presidente da Comissão Europeia, responsável por tornar a Europa pronta para a era digital e da concorrência. Bem-vindos ao podcast do Dinheiro Vivo, Made in Tech.
Can you believe it? Can you realize that we, that all of us, have actually begun the exploration of another world?
Olá, eu sou o João Tomé e este é o nosso quinto episódio desde que começámos nos últimos dias de 2020. E é um episódio especial. Primeiro porque é lançado à terça-feira e não à quinta à noite ou à sexta de manhã, como tem sido habitual. Depois porque temos connosco nada mais nada menos do que a dinamarquesa Margrethe Vestager. Ela não é só a vice-presidente da Comissão Europeia responsável por tornar a Europa pronta para a era digital da concorrência. Foi a temida Comissária Europeia da Concorrência que há vários anos que tenta pôr os gigantes tecnológicos na linha. Mas também é bem mais importante do que isso. Eu diria que é mesmo das pessoas com algum poder que junta mais inteligência, bom senso e sempre com uma visão científica, tecnológica, social e filosófica do tempo em que vivemos e também da forma como a era digital está a mudar as nossas vidas. A conversa que segue em inglês, pelo qual pedimos desde já as nossas desculpas, mas quem quiser pode ver a versão escrita no suplemento Dinheiro Vivo, que sai sábado com o DN e JN. Os temas começam com Vestager a ter uma postura diferente da de Angela Merkel, a chanceler alemã, que criticou Twitter e companhia por terem banido Donald Trump. Ou seja, ela, Angela Merkel, alega que o Twitter e outras empresas não tinham base legal para o banir e, portanto, deveriam ter usado uma base legal. Mas a verdade é que Margrethe Vestager não concorda com essa perspectiva e diz mesmo que Twitter e companhia têm legitimidade para banir Trump. Esta é uma discussão que não é só americana, neste domínio, é também europeia e portuguesa, já que o discurso inflamado que divide a sociedade e é recompensado com atenção nas redes sociais também está presente em Portugal, mais centrado em André Ventura, o candidato do Chega, que estará nas presidenciais de domingo, dia 24, a concorrer. Fizemos recentemente uma análise aos debates presidenciais, que está disponível em dinheirovivo.pt, que mostra precisamente como Ventura é o que faz mexer as redes sociais ligadas a todos os candidatos, não só com palavras a favor dele, mas também contra ele. Podem ver essa análise se pesquisarem no Google Reality Show Ventura Agida Redes Sociais. Com o Vestager falamos também das novas regras que a Comissão Europeia quer criar para tornar o discurso online menos agressivo. Falamos também brevemente sobre Joe Biden, que toma posse nos Estados Unidos já esta quarta-feira, 20 de janeiro, num Estados Unidos com cuidados extra para evitar episódios de violência que estavam a ser planeados por radicais. Sabe-se hoje disso mesmo por relatórios do FBI, isto depois do ataque ao Capitólio de algumas semanas. Biden pode ser mais útil do que Trump nas muitas mudanças que vão acontecer no mundo digital nos próximos anos. Destaques à parte, segue a conversa que tem uma particularidade. Foi gravada esta sexta-feira em plena visita dos comissários europeus a Lisboa para o arranque da presidência portuguesa da Comissão Europeia. Foi feita no CCB. Para conseguir entrevistar Vestager, tive de ir a correr da conferência de imprensa que estava a acontecer entre António Costa e Ursula von der Leyen para outra sala. E por isso mesmo, há alguma falta de fôlego no início. Segue então a entrevista.
So I will begin with one of the topics that is more important in terms of this week, these past weeks. We heard a lot about the United States, what happened in the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And of course, we heard about how social media banned Mr. Trump. And that began a more old but actual important talk about how can these platforms do this. If they should do this, if it's not what they should do, respecting mm-hmm. the laws of the countries. Mrs. Merkel has said that it was the wrong way to do it because the laws of the country don't permit it. But what is your view about what happened And sorry for my...
Yeah, no, you, sorry should, catch, for my, you should catch your breath.
Exactly. What is your view about what happened, and how is the Europe's view different from what happened?
Well, the first thing is that there is a consequences to ticking the little box mm-hmm. of accepting terms and conditions.
Of course.
And this may be what we see right now. It's a private service. Terms and conditions have been accepted. If you do not live by them, it has a consequence.
Even if you're a president of the United States.
Even if you're a president of the United States. Hmm. What we are trying to do here in Europe is to put a legal framework around this part of our public debate. Hmm. We have made a proposal that is called the Digital Services Act. And that basically says two things. On the one hand side, it says, if you do or say something illegal, that will have to go. Because we have agreed on what is illegal in the real world. Child abuse, excitement to violence, terror, bomb recipes. That will have to go, whoops, like that. But if it's not illegal in your country, it may be harmful, yes, but it's not illegal. If it's taken down, then you should be notified. You should be able to complain about it. And there should be independent arbitration if you cannot agree. Because it cannot just be a one-sided decision that this should go. Because otherwise we get too close to damaging freedom of expression. And, you know, it's, what is it, 50 years ago here in Portugal, you had a different system. Colleagues of mine in the commission were raised and grew up when the Iron Curtain was still down. You know, everyone is vaccinated against this idea that we should have sort of public authorities deciding what is wrong and what is right. What we should do instead is to make these processes to say what we have agreed on, what is illegal, is also illegal online. But when you do things that are harmful, you need to be able to complain about it. You need to have processes where you are being heard.
You talked about the possibility of a committee of some sort, probably in Europe, of Europe-centric. How can that work in terms, for example, Facebook has created his own committee for different types of things. How can that work in reality?
Well, for instance, if, now set aside what is illegal, but you're doing something which is not in accordance to the terms and conditions and what is considered harmful. And then the social media platform decides to take down your post. Then they will have to notify you. And if you don't agree, then you should be able to complain about it. And if they don't put it back on or you rest your case, then there should be an independent arbitration to say, well, is this right or is it wrong? Because this is, I think, one of the characteristics of our democracy, that's we talk about it in a manner that obliges us to listen to each other when it comes to these kind of situation. And the second thing is that our proposal is not about content, because we don't want our European democracy to decide what is illegal and what is legal. That is for national legislation or more specific European legislation. For instance, in my home country, Denmark, we have a quite robust public debate. Our neighbors, the Swedes, they're probably the most civilized people on this planet. So the Swedes would definitely not like it if they were to have the Danish debate and vice versa. So what we're trying to do is to frame it, but not to interfere with what is the national debate about what should be legal and what should be illegal. That being said, we see a tendency to countries converging more and more. And also, you know, not only child abuse and excitement to violence, but also, for instance, hate speech against minorities. So, of course, there is a movement where things becomes more and more the same. But it's still a matter for national legislation to decide what is legal and what is illegal when it comes to these things.
In terms of the arbitration you talked about, would be an European arbitration, a local, national arbitration?
It would be a local one.
Local one. Like a little bit like it happened with the GDPR.
Well, the thing is that we have so many languages here.
Of course, yeah.
And we have different, as I said, different levels of how we see things. So it's important that it is a local one.
In terms of framework, we talk about Europe, things take their time. What is the framework of the time of...
Well, you know, one of the things that I find really encouraging in being here today is to sense sort of the focus and the engagement and the dynamic of the Minister of Economics, who will be the main responsible person here, to really, you know, push these pieces of legislation so that we can have an agreement, maybe not in these 6 months, but soon thereafter. And it's really important what happened. We tabled these proposals before Christmas. And these first months, they are decisive as to how fast can it actually go. So it's really important that the Portuguese presidency has made this a very high priority.
In terms of what happened really in the United States, you don't see, because it's a private company, you don't see any problem from what the Twitter, Amazon Web Services, YouTube have done, right?
Well, as said, if things are illegal, then there is a consequence to it. And I think everyone will have to accept that, and that is also the case in the real world. If someone is trying to recruit people to take down the parliament, also in the real world, I tell you, the police will come.
Of course.
So I think it's important to distinguish between things being taken down before they are illegal, and then what is actually being an intrusion in your right to express yourself.
There's also a lot of talk in terms of how social media, but big tech, the algorithms are tracked down, what they do. It's all about their economic model. They focus on attention of people and engaging. And we know now from studies that polarizing content, it's more engaging. So the algorithm normally push that content a little bit more. It's good for more populist type of discourse in terms of political discourse, more aggressive discourse. What do you think about this framework that we live in now in terms of social media?
Well, I think it's very damaging, because if we get to live in our own private reality, then how can we ever discuss what are the societal problems that we should deal with? Because if you have your feed and the algorithm is just giving you more of what you like, but this is not what I like, so the algorithm is giving me something completely different, then how can we talk with one another? Because we see the world in two very different ways. I think as you see in the US, where some people are absolutely convinced that there has been massive voter fraud, while others are saying this is probably the best election that they have had for a very, very long time.
Even officials,
yes. And none of the Trump lawsuits, 61 of them, I think, have had any success. And yet you have people who have been feed that this has been stolen from us. This is all wrong. This is voter fraud. That is a big problem.
And how can we deal with it? Digital Service Act tries to put the focus on the algorithms, right?
It put focus on the algorithm to say, well, we need to have transparency as to how this works. We need for people, for researchers, for journalists to be able to see how this is actually working. We are not taking sort of the full step to make it forbidden to do micro-targeting, because there can also be some beneficial sides to that. But we think that with the transparency and with the insights as to how this is working, we could actually open this up. And I think the consequence is obvious, because if I read my morning paper, now I read it on my iPad, but it's still basically the same paper. You know, I get to see a lot of different things. I also see a lot of things that I would never, ever look for myself. I'm not a football fan, but I have a sense of what is going on in the football world as well, because I see that news. And I know that people who are, you know, intensively following the football fans, they will also see some of the news that I think is very, very important.
It's a sense of community.
It's a sense of community, and we need to get that sense of community back. And that is part of fighting for a true, vibrant democracy.
The Digital Service Act puts the pressure on the economic model of social media and big tech also, but that's why there's backlash from them, of course. It's their livelihood that is on focus. Do you think the laws that will come will change a bit in some way the economic model because of the personalized advertising?
I think a lot of things must happen at the same time before we get there, because we also want to make sure that we all have a digital identity, because that is, in my opinion, key for us taking control of our data. And when we get control of our data, then the business models can change for the better. And that will also, I think, give smaller businesses who are in the scale-up phase better opportunities to engage with us as customers. So it's not just the Digital Services Act or the Digital Markets Act or the e-identity. It's a number of things done at the same time that will allow, I think, a much better and more open marketplace when it comes to digital.
There's a lot of talk of break up big tech because they're monopolies, bigger and bigger. In the United States, new lawsuits has begun. There's a new administration with Biden with different views from the past. In Europe, also anti-competitive lawsuits. Do you think breaking them up is possible, is desirable, can help one of the objectives of the Digital Act, that is promote other companies to grow and compete?
Well, it is possible. And it would be possible already now if we found that breaking up a company would be the only solution to a problem. So far, we have not found that extreme illegal solution. Because obviously it's the most far-reaching thing that you can do, to say, well, no, you have to divest part of your company and so that a new competitor is created because of something you did. But as a matter of principle, it can be done. We have chosen a different way in the Digital Markets Act, because here we literally have gatekeepers for digital markets, giant businesses who decide how you do your business, if you can be found, if you cannot be found by potential customers. We have taken a full range of the experiences that we have from the antitrust work that I'm responsible for, and said, well, these are the things that you definitely cannot do. These are the things that you definitely have to do in order to open up the market so that smaller businesses get a chance of scaling up. And the reason why we have chosen this instead of saying, no, you have to be broken up, is that we think that we can better, you know, analyze what is actually then going to happen, because we don't know what will happen if businesses are broken up.
Of course, yeah.
We may just have a, instead of a monopoly, we may have a duopoly. So instead of one giant business, we have two giant businesses, but basically the rest is the same.
But it cannot, maybe it won't be Europe. Even the United States can break them up.
The United States can do that as well. And one of the cases in the US, the Facebook case, is indeed a case about Facebook being too big, with the acquisitions of WhatsApp and Instagram. There is a number of differences between European and the US antitrust legislation. In the US, they have a more sort of outright ban of monopolies. In Europe, actually, you're welcome to be so successful that you have de facto a monopoly, but then you get a different set of obligations, because with power comes responsibility. And it's this sort of very fundamental European idea that with power comes responsibility that we are now sort of enlarging with the Digital Markets Act.
There's a subject I think is very interesting. Australia has put up more legislation in terms of taxes on big tech to support local newspapers. They say it's the basis of democracy, and it's laws that will put money from the big pockets of money from the advertising in the country into local newspapers. France is trying to do something like this. There's some talks even global area. The United States wasn't participating, now could participate. Mm. What do you think is the best way? Can newspapers survive with money from the big tech?
Well, we took, I think, important steps with the changes in copyright legislation. Mm-hmm. That is not fully implemented yet, and more need to be done for that to work in full. Then we have the question about taxation. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important in sort of a very simple manner, because a huge majority of businesses, you know, they really have to work hard to make a profit. From that profit, they pay their taxes. Mm-hmm. They have to look at competitors competing for skilled employees, for customers, for capital, who do not contribute at the same level. Mm-hmm. So it's an outright question of tax fairness. And if we could agree, and preferably on a global scale, if not then on a European scale, then of course we would get a tax revenue that could be used in many different ways. And of course, one of the ways that it could be used was to support media, so that you could still maintain sort of a local media present with omnibus newspapers. Mm-hmm. Because one of the reasons why it has been so difficult is that in many instances, people have sort of unlearned to have a subscription, because papers has been based on advertising. But in some countries, at least 2/3 of advertising turnover goes to Facebook. Exactly. or Google. And that, of course, makes it very, very difficult to have a media presence. Mm-hmm. So the copyright legislation, when fully implemented, and hopefully to have digital taxation as well, should give this sense of a more balanced situation and a greater degree of fairness.
But you see importance of putting some money from this taxes on national newspapers for a better discourse in the country?
Well, I think it's important not to wait for that to happen. Mm-hmm. For instance, in the state aid work that I do, you know, we have very, very open gates for support to media, exactly for these reasons, because media plurality is so important, so that you can get one view in one paper and another view in another paper, and then you can make up your own mind.
Mm-hmm. What is, in terms of what will happen next, where do you see Europe going, even not only in an innovative framework, but also in terms of dealing with big tech? Where can we be in the space of 2 years' time? Things are changing, of course, but where do you want to be in the space of 2-3 years' time?
Well, first and foremost, I want these pieces of legislation to be passed and in the process of being implemented. Mm. But I also want Europe to be, you know, fully engaged in the next wave of digitization. Because now we have had sort of social media, mm-hmm. the Google, the Amazons, the Facebooks of this world. That is sort of the first big phase. But the next big phase is sort of the digitization of public services and of industry, where, you know, electricity becomes digital, agriculture, transport, health, everything. And here in Europe, we have a lot of things going for ourselves, because we have big welfare states. We have public health systems. We have public educational systems. When we digitalize that, that will work as a driver also for smaller businesses to be part of this. And we come from a European industrial culture, a culture of entrepreneurship, a culture of innovation. So if we play this right, you know, Europe can gain so much in this next phase.
Hmm. Even in terms of mobility, we talk a lot about mobility for the climate, but even for innovation. Where do you see mobility going in terms of the innovation and the climate change that we need?
Well, this is really
a lot of batteries.
This is really important. Because someone just showed me numbers to say that if fully digitalized, then in getting from A to B, we can save, like, I think, 35% of the carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. And we can also save between 15 and 20% of commuting times because we get better organized.
Okay.
So not only would we save in carbon emissions, but we would also have more time on our hands. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really good news. And that, of course, shows that the task is to make sure that we can trust technology, that the bad side of technologies are under control, so that we can go with all the positive things that technology can be used for.
There's a lot of talk of subscriptions now. Mm-hmm. Everyone does a subscription, even for newspapers. And of course, there's bundles. And when you're a big tech giant, you can have better bundles with lower prices for people. There's a lot of talk, there's too many subscriptions now, but can be subscriptions for mobility also. How can Europe try to navigate the subscription time? Is it
I think subscriptions as such is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And we're still in the process really to understand what are the downsides that should be dealt with. Mm-hmm. Because for a lot of people, money can be saved in subscribing to more than one thing at the same time. Mm-hmm. Again, I think what we have put in place in the prohibitions and the obligations for the big gatekeepers, you'd find some of the solutions so that it doesn't just serve the big ones, but that also smaller and upcoming companies can see that as a way actually to scale up.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for doing and for running from one side of the other of the Belém Cultural Center.
Yeah, they said I had to quick it up, so I did it.
It was very kind of you.
Thank you for your time.
I hope it makes sense for you. I really appreciate that you have such a presence because it's important, and for many people it's still this new world.
Exactly. No, we had a podcast on it, and my objective in the podcast is to show every episode new things, how technology is changing the world. And there's so much things now, even as we speak, that I'm doing more episodes than I would think, because I think it's a booming area that is transforming completely.
Completely. Also, when it comes to the pandemic, if it hadn't been for AI, we wouldn't have this understanding of the virus.
Of course.
We wouldn't have the vaccines now. That's a given.
Of course. Even the remote work, remote teaching, it's a good area too.
All of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
E foi a entrevista. Se tivesse mais uma hora, daria para esmiuçar melhor alguns temas, já que de facto é um prazer falar com Vestager sobre vários temas. É uma pessoa que tem de facto muito conhecimento sobre a era digital e ideias novas para transmitir. Por causa desta ser uma temática muito interessante, amanhã vamos publicar uma conversa sobre alguns destes temas com a jornalista da prestigiada publicação norte-americana Politico, Laura Kiely, que é especializada em tecnologia e em política europeia. Ela vai nos ajudar a abordar alguns destes temas, a esmiuçar alguns destes temas. Teremos ainda um outro episódio extra, desta feita com alguém que é português, a advogada Cláudia Martins, especializada em Direito Europeu da Concorrência, em tecnologia e privacidade, que nos vai dar aqui uma perspectiva mais portuguesa destas temáticas. Este tema, o da forma como o debate público acontece online, eu diria que é mesmo urgente e mais relevante do que muitos pensam, e daí que vamos pouco a pouco dando destaque a ele aqui no podcast. A verdade é que não é só nos Estados Unidos com Trump, é também cá, cada vez mais, com pessoas a ficarem incendiadas, a aderirem a extremos, a teorias da conspiração, coisas que podem ter consequências profundas não só para as democracias, como as conhecemos, mas também para a forma como lidamos com a pandemia. As narrativas falsas ou enviesadas proliferam online, essencialmente porque Facebook ou YouTube são baseadas em texto ou vídeo editado, dá uma perspectiva às vezes um pouco mais leve das coisas, que se víssemos ou víssemos alguém dizer aquilo na rua, se calhar não levávamos tão a sério. A verdade é que este tipo de situações têm consequências que tornam, por exemplo, o confinamento que agora vivemos em Portugal menos eficaz e podem levar, de facto, à destruição da forma como vemos o mundo, portanto, uma forma mais comunitária de vermos o mundo, vermos o outro lado, não só o nosso lado. Vou contar só uma história, só para dar também algum contexto neste domínio. Em agosto, senti-me tentado a fazer uma notícia, porque um médico psiquiatra aposentado do Porto deu uma entrevista a uma página de Facebook, que até se dedicava mais a entretenimento, onde ele garantia que já existia cura para a Covid. Dava mesmo a entender que estava a ser escondida essa solução, e o vídeo já se tinha tornado viral quando eu vi, já tinha sido visto por dezenas de milhares de pessoas, e muitas delas, claro, a acreditar no que estava ali. Citava o estudo, este médico citava um estudo do México, incentivava as pessoas a tomar este medicamento. Eu achei aquilo grave, porque achei que de facto não tinha grande base científica, aquilo que ele estava a dizer, e na verdade estamos a falar de um médico psiquiatra, não era propriamente um médico especializado nestas áreas. Procurei o estudo em causa, percebi que ele tinha pouca credibilidade, era um estudo com muito poucas pessoas no México, de facto, e depois contactei também o Conselho Nacional de Saúde Pública em Portugal, que me disse que aquilo de facto não tinha nenhuma base científica, não havia nenhuma prova que aquilo fosse minimamente verdade. Falei com a Ordem dos Médicos, disse exatamente o mesmo, e falei ainda com a Organização Mundial de Saúde, que me indicaram que estavam a ser estudadas mais de 200 tratamentos para a Covid a nível mundial, e aquele não era um deles, porque de facto não tinha credibilidade aquele estudo. O meu artigo, que escrevi sobre este tema, dando estas indicações todas, posso dizer que foi bem menos lido do que esse vídeo. Mesmo depois de contactar os responsáveis dessa página de Facebook, publicou essa entrevista, eles não quiseram tirar o vídeo porque estava a ser muito visto, estava-lhes a dar notoriedade. Portanto, é apenas um exemplo com que nos despedimos esta semana. A nossa semana de podcast fica concluída esta sexta-feira com o episódio habitual das sextas, e desta vez é com Teresa Virgínia, que já foi responsável pela área Teams da Microsoft Portugal, lidera agora a comunicação. Vamos falar com ela sobre a explosão e evolução em Portugal da plataforma colaborativa Teams, que é muito focada também no vídeo e que tem no Zoom e no Slack dois grandes rivais. Vamos também falar na conferência Building the Future, uma conferência que chega na próxima semana com convidados de luxo, inclusive o português José Neves, e que tem, é organizada aqui pela Microsoft Portugal. E pronto, este podcast foi criado por mim, João Tomé, e é editado pelo Luís Stoffel. Podem enviar sugestões de temas ou de convidados para os próximos episódios para o meu Twitter, estou em @emote, ou então enviem para joao.tomé@dinheirovivo.pt. Se gostou do que ouviu, siga-nos nas principais plataformas, da Apple ao Spotify, partilhe, avalie, faça-nos sugestões. Até ao próximo episódio de Made in Tech, do Dinheiro Vivo. Até à próxima.